Glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. Our October Cardi Party featured James Hewison, Head of Film Programs at ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image. James explored the function of cinema as an agent for change, and he also invited a special guest to join him, filmmaker Amiel Corton-Wilson.
Hi everybody, thanks for your patience. The library's closed, as you probably know, so we're trying to just make sure everyone... But we're just trying to make sure that everyone can get in, which is the... But we're very fortunate that the Melbourne Library Service has given us their space, and Daniela has been very fantastic in helping us, so thank you, Daniela, and the IT. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Okay, so I'd like to start by acknowledging the visitors of the Land on which we're meeting, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and any other elders or community members in the audience today. I always forget to do this. I always forget to introduce myself. I'm Nick McGrath. I actually know most of your faces, so you probably all know me. Justine, Hannah, who is downstairs welcoming in people in the library, and Hugh Rundle, who is tweeting from the back. We've also got Claire Presser, who's over in Philly at the moment working, and over in Perth, we've got Andrew Kelly, who we make up. We call ourselves Cardi Corp. I'll explain that later. It's not a cult, I promise. So that's our introductions. I'd also like to introduce James Hewison, who's here from ACME. He's the Head of Film Programs, which is the reason why you're here today. But something you didn't know, which is a bit of a surprise, and we're fortunate to have Amiel Curtin-Wilson here, who's a director and producer. And actually, I did a bit of a catalogue search, and there's three of your films are in the catalogue in this library, so I was pretty happy about that. So there's Hail, Bastardy, and Ben Lee, Catch My Disease, which I'm sure you're happy to hear. There you go. The other thing I have to say is, and I'm following my notes because otherwise I'll just start rambling. everyone knows me. We've got a code of conduct and an anti-harassment policy, which I'm not sure if any of you realise. So if you go to our website, it's important to have a read of that, because we're about being inclusive and safe. This is a safe space for glam professionals and friends. So we just want you to know that that's on our website. So just have a read. It's nothing too serious. All of you guys are wonderful. We've never had a problem, but so that we continue not to have problems, we have that policy as well. The other thing I should say is that we're recording this. So there's going to be a talk with James and a Q&A afterwards. So just be aware that this is being recorded. If you have any problems with that, just please let me know at the end. Just come and see me. What else am I going to tell you? Oh, Glam World Club. This is why I have notes. How I ended up here is the Glam Blog Club being this month. I'm not sure how many people have been reading the blogs. I've already done mine, which I got in a bit early, which is because I'm being super organised. And I know that a few people in the audience have done a blog this month already, but if you don't know about it, go on our website and have a look. And please start blogging and read other people's blogs. That would be really great. And talk about each other's blogs. That would be fantastic. Other thing I wanted to tell you, the latest CardiCast episode was an interview I did with Anna Takiya a few months ago. Anna's an exhibition producer and she's fantastic. So it's a free podcast, so please, again, go on our website and have a listen if you haven't already done so. And the last thing, before I hand over to James, our next Cardi Party next month is going to be at the Pram Mechanics Institute, and we'll post a little bit about that. So yeah, just have a look on our website. Yes, there you go. Perfect. So yeah, basically, if you're not on our mailing list, get onto the mailing list and then you can see all the things that we're doing. And I'll just hand over to James. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for having me and us. I'm not quite sure who you are, but you look you look like a nice group of people. So I start off with a confession. I was going to prepare something super spiffy, PowerPoint, cite some kind of seminal thinkers, provide you with empirical evidence, but I'm not going to do that, largely because I'm not very good at doing that. I get kind of bored pretty easily, to be honest. But there were four things that actually happened in the last couple of days that I would like to relate to you. The first is, and these are quite tangential to the broad-ranging theme of this evening's discussion, but they will make sense. So the other day, a talented filmmaker, lovely young guy, who has been showing me different cuts of his short film over the last couple of weeks. When we were talking about the most recent cut, day before yesterday, and he was very prescriptive. The film is a real kind of flight of fancy, very imaginative piece, a fable. And he had this very prescribed series of questions. And I said, well, look, and he was recording our conversation, which has never happened to me before in that kind of environment. And I said, well, why don't we just have a chat? Because I'd feel a lot more comfortable with that. And hopefully it will provide some kind of creative inspiration for you. And I said, so what's some of the feedback that you've been getting already? And he said, well, there's this one funding agency who may or may not give me money. And they said, who are you making your film for? And he said, well, I'm not really thinking about who I'm making my film for in terms of the audience at the moment. And they said, well, that's a big problem. Because you need to, when you conceive of the story, you need to start imagining who the audience is. We'll get to that in a moment with Emil. And they then speculated that the target audience for this film that he was making was international festival programmers, which I thought was odd because the function of international festival programmers is to act as intermediaries. And it's that point about intermediaries that I'd like to discuss a little bit more, because I think perhaps some of you are possibly intermediaries. The other thing that happened, in fact, yesterday, so ACME is planning a very substantial renewal project for the entire building. So we're reconceiving of not only the physical space, but indeed what should go, what should populate it, and what should its philosophy be. So we've set longer term strategic objectives, and yesterday we had amongst other conceptual meetings, we had a meeting which was about literacy, screen literacy in particular. And my wonderful fellow comrades talked a lot about audience segments, and the conversation was filled with the stuff that often I just sort of glaze over, I have to say. And I said, well, that's obviously, we're a public institution, we're avowedly for the public, our audiences, but surely literacy is equally about for practitioners, for makers, for filmmakers, for artists. That's vitally important too, and we need to serve that function. The third thing that happened to me recently, which happily does occur from time to time with some regularity, is that I saw an amazing film. And I actually want to show you the trailer for this film. It's not a film that this guy's made, but we'll get to that in a moment. I'm not going to tell you about it. I'm just going to show it to you.
Same. Mother the Tarak, Willow Sluhut, can be not only beating me, giving me, begging me. The Luya Fruyum can be Luya Saluni. Rehdish Mintu, Lissata Birazi, Marehti Mut. Herbert, can Adam, وفجأة لقيت حالي هون بحفرة تانية تحت الأرض. أبلش بداية السفر، مد إيده على جيبته وأعطاني مفاتيح بيتنا، قال لي بس تبلش الحرب المعمار جي بيروح على بلد تاني خلص حرب، وبينطروا الحرب ببلد لا تخلص ويرجعوا يعملوها. بعدني ناطر.
So this film was a very low-budget experimental documentary feature film made by a young Syrian who is in exile in Berlin, lives in Berlin. And he has made this film about young builders from various cities, and most of these are the men on this construction site in Beirut, are from the city of Raqqa. And the images that they're watching on their phones are of their streets, which have been progressively destroyed. And the story, the fable-like story that the voiceover narration recounts, is that generation after generation throughout their family's history, really, who are builders, and they have to leave. In this case, these young men have had to leave their various cities, particularly Raqqa, to go to Beirut because their city is being destroyed by war, in order to go onto a construction site where they are not welcome, and they live immediately beneath the construction site in order to rebuild Beirut after the war and the ravages that have been wrought on that particular city. So I saw that film on Saturday of last week. I contacted the filmmaker and I got the link, and I've seen it again twice. And I'd watched that trailer probably two or three times a day ever since, because it gives... I mean, it's hard to determine from having seen 2.5 minutes worth of a really extraordinary film, but it gives agency to some of the voices and the dignity of those, and the impossibility, the vertiginous impossibility of the men who are represented in the film. So, and the fourth thing that I experienced was, of course, it's imperative if we're going to talk about cinema and the agency of cinema as an agent of change, to actually have a filmmaker. So Emil Corton Wilson, who has three of his works in this very library. So you have made it, man. So Emil is an artist and a filmmaker whose practice, Energy and Intelligence, thumbs its nose at, his own nose, at orthodox boundaries and borders. His most recent filmed work, The Silent Eye, which we'll have a look at part of in a moment, premiered at the Whitney Museum last year, and his shorts and features have screened internationally at festivals as diverse as Sundance, Cannes and Venice. And he also, other of his work, has screened at a range of galleries and institutions both here as well as elsewhere. Please welcome Emil Corton Wilson.
I have to say, first, that trailer is fucking amazing.
Yes.
I've not seen that before. Mm. That's unbelievable. Wow.
What are some of the films, Emil, that you have seen that have changed your perception of cinema, and why?
Yeah.
Or how?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I think going back to when I was 7 years old, my father was a big cinephile, so he sort of force fed me a lot of cinema from a very young age, for better or worse. But I remember when I was 8, I sat down to watch Dog Day Afternoon, a remarkable film about a bank robbery, mid-70s film with Al Pacino. And just very quickly, there was something about the energy in that film that I couldn't quite place as a young child. With the opening sequence in that movie, even though the rest of the film is scripted and plays out in a very taut, tense, single location, the opening is basically a series of documentary shots of portraits of the town in which the robbery takes place. And I couldn't articulate why I found that so potent, but it was something about introducing a world or an energy of the actual of the world into an otherwise constructed narrative. That was a sort of, I was getting a taste of something I enjoyed.
How did you know what was, well, real, which is to say what was shot as documentary material and what was not? And how did you discern the difference, and what was the significance of one over the other?
There was a charge. I think there's just a charge in the imagery that I, again, you know, being a child, I couldn't articulate at the time, but I was very drawn towards. Leaping forward maybe 10 years, I remember seeing a short film by a Cuban filmmaker called Santiago Alvarez called Now. He was a remarkably prolific Cuban filmmaker from the late 50s through to died in 2000. And Now, because of his limited resources working in Cuba, permanently worked in newsreel form, but he made this series of amazing found footage films, sort of essay style short documentaries, and he was famously once quoted as saying all he needed to make a film was two images and a piece of music. and he could fashion a narrative out of that, which I thought was a remarkably inspiring kind of call to arms for, you know, certainly myself as a 17-year-old at that time with limited resources. So that film is 5 minutes long. It's basically comprised of unusual footage of the civil rights movements, civil rights movement, most particularly like police brutality in that period. And it's set to music, so it's a strange kind of prototype for a very palatable and visceral, you know, almost like a music clip form in terms of how it plays out. The film literally ends with the sound of a machine gun spelling out the word "now" on a white background, and it was just such a pure and visceral piece of political filmmaking. And it's on YouTube. You guys can, you know, it's unbelievable. It's the first, whenever I teach at film schools, it's the first film I show to students who are, you know, at times can be, you know, lost in terms of, you know, what to begin with. And I always begin with that Santiago quote, just two pictures and a piece of music. So that would be another film that was, yeah, unbelievably influential. And then one other, let me think, probably the work of John Cassavetes. So I was, again, 17, sat down, saw his fourth film, which is a film called Faces, which he shot over 2 years in 1968 on 16mm. The film stars his wife, Jenna Rollins. It was shot in his house. And again, it was something, it was shot over weekends with primarily friends over a period of 2 years. And that movie just changed my life, absolutely. Again, because it managed to capture a psychological complexity and there's a compassion and a rawness in that film. The film's basically about a middle-aged couple who, estranged from one another, go on their own individual journeys of respective infidelity, only to be reunited at the end of the night in this kind of very, in like an impasse of sorts, and return to the family home after having both strayed from their marriage for one evening. And it's amazing, amazing time capsule of late 1960s America and the hypocrisy and the, I suppose, the intergenerational change at that time. But it was, you know, to sit there and watch a film on VHS in 1997 in a flat in Elwood, and to be transported with such, again, visceral intensity to Los Angeles in 1967, into this married couple's world, I knew that was a type of filmmaking that I wanted to explore. And it was the first time for me that film, with that movie in particular, had reached the heights of psychological complexity that I'd experienced reading a novel. And it was like, wow, you can really actually have that emotional bandwidth in 90 minutes rather than the usual kind of arcs that we're subjected to.
So the politics is, of course, based on power structures. Film is the most industrial of all of the arts. Film is therefore political by its very inherent nature. Would you agree?
Yes.
And how should... Do you sense that audiences have evolved in their relationships to cinema in the course of the time that you've been making films?
Absolutely. I've been making films... I mean, I made my first film 27 years ago. I've been making films consistently, having left high school 20 years ago. So I think there's been a number of shifts, and I think it's interesting you were talking earlier about screen literacy, visual literacy. I was just on the jury of a documentary film festival in Sydney last week, and that was, it's always really interesting to have that kind of experience, as you would know, programming, but to sort of sit down and watch, you know, upwards of, you know, 15 films in the space of 3 days, just to get a really great, you know, albeit limited, but some sense of an insight into what's been made just in the last year. And I'm really taken by the way in which filmmakers are borrowing from all forms of cinema, be it documentary borrowing from drama and drama borrowing from documentary, and the way in which audiences now can, you know, I remember, say, 20 years ago, the idea of something as simple as a dramatic recreation would be something that, you know, was something for an audience to wrap their head around. And I think that things like that in documentary are now, part and parcel.
Commonplace.
Yeah, and people are looking for conscious blurring of those forms, or, you know, setting up certain parameters only to kind of upturn those forms of cinema language. So I think there's a sophistication now that filmmakers are responding to. I feel like it's becoming exponential, that sophistication as well. Especially, and interestingly, you're talking about a younger filmmaker. I mean, you know, speaking to filmmakers in high school even last week, it's remarkable how just how quick people absorb and can adapt and employ these devices.
And is that to say that there's a more sophisticated screen literacy on the part of filmmakers? And if so, why is that? What's that evolution due to, would you say?
Yeah, I think there is a more sophisticated screen literacy. I suppose the question is, to what end? And that's really, like, what I find to be the issue in a lot of film schools is, and this is a much bigger discussion around who we are as a country, and was chatting again with these fellow jury members, both of whom went from Australia last year, and it's their first time to Australia, and they were seeing a lot of Australian films as well as a lot of international films. And they, you know, one producer from New York very bluntly, you know, asked the question, so why don't you guys make very many good movies? Because, you know, like, occasionally you do, but, you know, given the size of your country and the amount of support you guys get. And it kickstarted a whole conversation about, you know, the fact that there isn't an urgency in a lot of our work, because I don't think we see ourselves clearly as a country, and we haven't admitted our genocidal history, and until we do that with a blistering honesty, I don't think we can. It's like there's a wax that's sort of poured over our collective psyche. Mm-hmm. So I think until that wax is melted, we can sort of start engaging with some deeper issues in terms of who we are as a people. I think we're going to continue making fairly mediocre stuff for the most part.
Obviously, yes, I would agree.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Obviously there's lots of voices that aren't.
And just to qualify the formal point, which is to say that Australia is the most subsidised film industry in the world?
Probably.
Yeah. Is the most subsidised, is the most regulated due to that subsidy.
Yeah.
And certainly there's an abundance of screen agencies, there's an abundance, at least ostensibly, of public money available compared to other nations.
Yeah.
And yet, as you say, the quality of the work, I mean, again, I'm sure, like Emil, I'm curious, obviously, to get the feedback from you guys. So how is it possible, therefore, given our theme of film as an agent of change, part of what I've been saying, or what I was proposing clumsily before, is that it's not just about making sure that more Australian audiences come and see more Australian films, because the films themselves need to be more sophisticated in the first instance.
Yeah.
And currently it seems that we're doing a slow backstroke in a morass of mediocrity, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, freestyle. Not maybe. Willingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, certainly.
Because Australia doesn't have, I mean, again, speaking in generalities, but Australia doesn't have, at least in filmmaking practice, certainly not the last 20 years, doesn't really have, in terms of capital P political filmmaking, we don't have that tradition.
No, there are, you know, occasional blips on the radar in terms of who, you know, has been making overtly political work, but I think it's really key that, I mean, I don't know how much of an aside this is in terms of the conversation, but I think right now filmmakers split their focus between commercial imperatives and creative, and I think there needs to be a space cordoned off for filmmakers to solely foster the creative, mm-hmm. and to really be able to work in a, albeit low budget, more low budget realm, but to subsidise the work of filmmakers who are telling stories that do have that urgency and do have that formal rigour and do push those boundaries. So until that happens, I mean, obviously you can also be a Santiago Alvarez and just go out and do it. I mean, like the work of Warwick Thornton's most recent feature doc,
mm-hmm.
We Don't Need a
Map.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is, I think, a great example of that. You know, really irreverent but very, very far-reaching, you know, political documentary made mm-hmm. from a very, very personal point of view, and and also, yeah, but made, it's got a great tactile, personal kind of quality about it. If we could make more films like that, I think, yeah.
Would anybody like to?
Do you want to know who we are? Because you asked that, Jason.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because it's probably me talking to a group of So who works in libraries here? Put your hand up. And who works in museums and archives? And anyone else here from other sort of sectors?
Records.
Yes.
Records.
So we call ourselves GLAMR, so galleries, libraries, archives, and museums, and
yes.
records as
yes.
well. So that's, and there's people, friends of GLAMR are here as well probably, that work aligned with those sorts of professionals. So I'm an archivist.
Mm.
Justine is a librarian, and Hugh's a librarian. There's a lot of librarians in the room. So there you go. We're
yeah.
in a library, so there you go. Sorry.
Guys
are
doing an amazing job.
Now you know who you're talking to.
Yeah, okay.
Excellent.
So we should just completely scrap what we were planning.
No, we all love film, so that's why
okay.
we're here. So, yeah.
Okay.
So I just wanted you to know who we are.
Well, in a way, we have made a provocation. Provocation is both Emil as a practitioner, myself as a programmer, as a curator, and someone who watches a bunch of movies. We've made a declaration that a lot of Australian cinema is mediocre. And that's not just because, well, at least I'll speak for myself, I hope I'm not a snob. I largely am, but I desperately want Australian stories to be told, and that's what those funding agencies say to us, but the stories that we are being force-fed are so inert and don't have anything to do with the culture that I'm familiar with.
Sorry, someone's got a question?
No, sorry. So that would be the role of ACME then? Because you see, yeah, going outside that commercial imperative that so many cinemas, even independent cinemas have, Nova or whatever, but you do it differently again. And how does that work to the agency of change? From my observation, you do it differently. And it's a great broad reach, and it can also hone in on issues and things like that.
Well, Greater Metropolitan Melbourne, and most particularly the CBD and the 10 kilometres around the CBD, is one of the most densely populated. Sorry, let me get the language right. We have amongst the largest penetration of cinemas per capita in the world, in Australia, in Melbourne. Sorry, I should say. Melbourne, quite precisely. So you'd think with that level of choice that would presume plurality of voice. Film is our business. It's about the commercial imperatives. But what we're talking about is on the other side of the street, and one presumes the other to a degree, which is the cultural side of the street. So the significance of what film is. And look, if people want to eat McDonald's, then that's ultimately their choice. They'll, you know, have all sorts of issues because for every act there's a consequence. But one of the reasons that I jettisoned doing a presentation because I felt like I was going to sound like a mouthpiece for ACME, and that's, I mean, I'm incredibly proud of what we do there. But one of the things, certainly over the, I'm not sure that this is quite directly answering what I think is a question, at ACME is, and, you know, we only have two cinemas, so it's actually quite, compared to the Novas and the Kinos, which on average have at least five or six cinemas, so they're churning through product all of the time. And cinemas don't make money from ticket sales. No cinema in the world makes money from ticket sales. They make money from food and beverage sales over what used to be called candy bars. So that's all about volume of punters, us, ultimately. So they don't give a shit, ultimately, as to what it is that's hitting the screen. And I dare say a lot of the people that go back to the bar after seeing a film for an hour and a half with their friends about to order another bottle of Pinot Noir, they've probably even forgotten what it was that they saw at the cinema, because that's not the reason why they're there in the first instance. ACME, we have a function and a role and a responsibility as a cultural institution that is not just to show Australian films because of their postcode, but to actually have a public debate about, okay, for example, when Australian filmmakers send their work to me and we say, well, we're not going to screen it, and I'll email them and I will say, if you want to have a chat about why that is, I mean, that's a negative example, then that's a conversation that should be had, because it is a very what's the best way to describe the hermetically sealed environment of filmmaking practice in Australia? This strange,
yeah, I
terror-like.
There's a lot of entitlement, I think, for all the good that subsidies do. I think it also, people rely on them and in a way that can lead to all kinds of atrophying of creative endeavours.
Mm.
bad news, I think, compared to cultures like in America where there's people are relying on a kind of creative bartering system more often than not. And you see, you know, DV, just a vague, just a quick indication, you know, the average, a low-budget film in Australia is considered anything $1 million or under. Most films, $2, $3, $4 million. In America, the equivalent, $100,000 to $300,000. You know, that's kind of the average for a film festival.
And films are made in a year, year and a half. Here,
5 to 7 years is the average for an Australian film.
Well, is that because of regulation? What you were saying before about us being quite a heavily funded industry, but thus heavily regulated, does that constrain voices in Australia?
Yeah, there's all kinds of cultural gatekeeping that goes on with Screen Australia, the main federal agency. Things like you're only eligible for certain kinds of funds or higher tiers of funds if you've made two films beforehand. How do you make the first films in the first place? There's a culture of like the obsession with the new, which I find repulsive and is really against mid and later career artists. They brought a recent change to the funding system where films before 2000 no longer count as a credit. So if you're an older filmmaker who might have had a family, who might be coming back to filmmaking, who might be coming to filmmaking having just retired, or like my aunt who went to law school at age 57 and is now a practicing lawyer at age 65, you know, all this work before. So there's lots of things wrong with how Screen Australia operates. And a lot of that also is like, you know, to get a film funded, you need to have your sort of stamp of approval. A lot of that involves just waiting in line long enough and just beating on their door for a number of years. A lot of people don't then get funding, but you know, you go through script development. That could be two or three drafts of a screenplay over two or three, 4 years, and then if you're lucky, you get production money. But then Australia is littered with the corpses of film directors who only make one film, who never make a second film, because again, we're not interested in the fostering of creative voices. We're interested in maybe this shiny new thing will play at Sundance, and that can be put into a report to send to the minister to say that this many people at the Los Angeles premiere came and Russell Crowe was there, and all those usual things.
But culture and civilization, which of course is what you most particularly, you guys know, is built on this idea of a body of work. Because otherwise, every single book sitting on that shelf, are they books?
Yeah.
The equivalent would be that they're each are by individual authors who are never published again. So how can that define who we are? Mm-hmm. How can you become our culture and indeed then become a civilization if there isn't a body of work?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as much as there's a fetishizing of, you know, the brand new director just out of film school, the number of remarkable filmmakers I know in their late 50s who just can't seem to like get another film funded or can't get a space for them to continue practicing their craft. And these are people with, you know, a huge number of accolades, BAFTA awards, with, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 you know, actor awards, our sort of Australian Academy Award equivalent, Academy Award nomination, you know. That's a fairly bleak, I suppose, picture.
Is that why they go overseas, do you think? Australian filmmakers go overseas?
I think a lot of Australian filmmakers go overseas just for the scale of budget and for this idea of penetration of their work into like a global, like, you know, there's a certain, you know, and you could attest to this, like the vast majority of any, you know, Canada has a national film production, you know, they make dozens of features a year.
They make, through the subsidised system, we make on average between 22 and 26 features a year. Canada makes on average, I mean, obviously the context is very different, but they make on average something like 50 subsidised films a year, feature films.
And if you think about how many Canadian films we see and how many actually travel, you know, you're talking about an infinitesimal number of each country's films will actually, you know, get a true kind of worldwide release, you know. So you might have, if you're lucky, maybe 2 or 3 Australian films a year.
Max, yes.
You know. And most often they're co-productions, you know, that have, you know, your Lions or there'll be an international component to that to kind of help them travel. So I think most people leave for that reason. They're just sick of their work only being seen here.
Yeah.
And that's certainly why I've travelled overseas.
And indeed, in some cases, to seek creative inspiration
for
elsewhere.
Sure.
I mean, we shouldn't be bound by... We shouldn't be just girt by sea. which is a perfect segue from one girt to another.
To leave these shores and go to New York City.
To screen you a clip. Okay, I'm going to...
Yes.
we're not going to play the whole feature film. So how should we navigate...
I might just pick a little piece at random.
That'd be great.
So it's the Vimeo one.
Is this the... Okay.
Yeah, it's the one at the bottom. So this is a remarkable... It's a film. It's a film work that's called Silent Eye. Do you want to talk a little bit about its genesis before we check it out?
It's a performance film. It's a feature film that I made about the jazz pianist Cecil Taylor, who's 87-year-old jazz pianist living in Brooklyn, New York. He's sort of one of the, I suppose, alongside Ornette Coleman, one of the musicians who was responsible for the coining of the phrase free jazz in the late 1950s. I found Cecil, met Cecil early 2014, ended up befriending him, moved in with him, became his archivist. That was my first run-in with becoming, scanning thousands of pages of his scores and poetry and diaries and letters. Actually, it was remarkable, not dissimilar to Australia, but the utter lack of interest in jazz musicians in New York universities and libraries was amazing. Couldn't find someone to help me with that work anyway, other than students. But so I've lived with Cecil for about a year and a half, and making a larger biopic about his life, and this film grew out of that. So it's a 70-minute performance film, which is basically the meeting of one of his key collaborators, which is a butoh dancer, Min Tanaka, 75-year-old Japanese, amazing, iconic butoh dancer. And the film was shot over 3 days in his home, and it's a film that's, I suppose, existed. It's equally at home in a museum setting as it is in film festivals. So I'll just show you a couple of minutes. It's a film that would never have received film funding from an Australian screen agency, primarily because it's 70 minutes set in one room of, an 87-year-old free jazz pianist and a 76-year-old butoh dancer just doing their thing. So I had to go to the United States, found a philanthropist who supported the film, and the film was commissioned by the Whitney Museum. So we had a premiere at the Whitney, and again, this is another point, just, I've experienced again and again. It was only when the film had premiered at a place like the Whitney that people in Australia were then interested, and then so the film's now screened at the MCA and is screened at Melbourne Film Festival, and that, I think, is a sad but all too true thing.
Which is to say that it had, because it had the approbation of a substantial public art institution, that it became legitimate.
Yeah, certainly. Mm. Yeah, I mean, really no one gave a fuck before that happened. Like, really. Just like, who's Cecil Taylor? Don't care. Who's Mr. Darwin Tanaka? Really don't care. But the Whitney, that's cool, so we'll have a look, which is fine. I mean, but it does say a lot about the, all experimental and a lot of funding options for filmmakers have, that did exist 10, 15 years ago have subsequently sort of shut down. And I think it's, if I could ask a question of you guys, I mean, it's part of tonight about thinking about how you change your programs in various libraries in terms of its public programs. Is that what the goal is?
I don't know if that's the goal. I think we just wanted to discuss, the ACME's new direction. And I thought it was really interesting what James wanted to talk about, agents of change. I think that affects everybody. Because we in the glam profession, we can't stay neutral, politically neutral. And I think...
You can't?
We can't.
You can't stay politically
neutral.
We are neutral, but what does that actually mean? And we don't interrogate that nearly enough as a sector.
Huh.
Part of the reason why we started these sorts of meetings and gatherings is to share information and to hear from the wider sector what you're doing, your thoughts, your directions, so that it inspires us and informs us as a group, as a sector as well.
So I should have done that PowerPoint presentation, huh? I'd love to be about it. Is that you're keeping an eye on things?
In stats,
the
very stats are very key.
Mm-hmm.
To libraries and what they do. And stats, well, it's possible in some ways. You can see that
correlation.
Yeah, absolutely. That sort of similarity. Therein lies potentially the danger of that.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm thinking. And a question sort of along those lines too, when you're talking about the lack of opportunities. So how does that go with features, say drama and documentaries? Does documentary suffer further because of those imperatives or not? Or?
Look, I think that the general sense that you can just go out and start making a documentary yourself, I wish more people felt that way about drama because it's very possible. One of the most amazing feature films out of the United States that I've seen in the last 5 years was made for $12,000. It was shot on an old VHS camera in a house with a group of actors in 10 days. It's a great movie called Stinking Heaven and played at Melbourne Film Festival. If more Australian filmmakers realised that they could just literally get a group of actors together and a borrowed camera, and as long as you've got an interesting script and interesting performers, you can actually make something. I wish there was more risk-taking and more people going out there and doing that. But to answer your question, I think both suffer for sure in terms of the main problem is filmmakers don't feel, they feel like they've already been browbeaten or they've lost before they've even started. I mean, part of being an artist is the mistakes and the being able to test the waters in ways that hopefully further the language of cinema. I mean, you'd think that would be the goal, is to like actually be pushing things rather than remaining in this very safe, tepid, formal area. And it's just really, the really sad thing for me is to see filmmakers who, I'm 38 now, but to see filmmakers who are like 20, 23, 25, not even sort of going through that phase, they go straight to the careerist opportunities of, well, this will be the film that plays at Sundance, this will be how I get an agent, this will be how I go to America. And it's like, well, what about fostering more of a fabric of community? I mean, I don't even like using the term industry about the Australian film. Like, what does that even mean, the film industry? We don't have an industry, we have a government that pays the majority of our wages, unless you work in television commercials or industrial films. And it's a community, certainly, but I think we should be a lot more inclusive, and you and I have spoken a lot about this, is just burn down this silo mentality between film schools, institutions, state funding bodies, film festivals between states. If there was a, I mean, and you guys is a key, in terms of...
Yeah, absolutely.
You were saying earlier about screen literacy, though, how much do you think the audience needs to understand better or demand better, more real stories like that rather than a lot of American cultural content and that kind of thing?
I made a film called Hail 6 years ago. It's a very simple story about a guy just out of prison reunited with his... Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
it's a difficult film for a lot of people. It's quite abstract in certain sequences. But the most telling screening that I had of that film anywhere was we did a charity screening for a prisoner advocacy group in Melbourne at the Nova. It was non-cinephile, pretty straight kind of crowd. And I had a retired cop come up to me and Danny, the lead actor in the film afterwards, and in tears. And this is a film that the last 40 minutes of the movie is there's no dialogue. It's, you know, just like a song, sort of sensory barrage. It's a pretty abstract kind of film. And in tears saying that it was the most eloquent portrayal of post-traumatic stress that he'd seen on screen. And that if he hadn't come to this charity screening, he would never have even heard about it. He didn't even know what the Nova was. You know, so that retired cop from Geelong getting to the Nova to get to a charity screening to see this movie Hail and have had that experience, you know, that's what I'm interested in as a filmmaker. And if that you could, I personally believe that, you know, most audiences are way more sophisticated. Not believe, I know they're way more sophisticated than people give them credit for. And if you just, you know, instead of, it's like what's in your refrigerator. If instead of what was, you know, you're changing the channel to, if there was something amazing like Taste of Cement and it was on, you know, aside from, I'm a great believer in people actually ascending if you like just can find them and connect them to the work.
Look at MIF. Like MIF is hugely popular in Melbourne. Like people take 2 weeks off, you know, work to go and spend every day watching films. Like I think that's just says a lot about Melbourne audiences. I don't know.
Totally.
Places,
totally.
It sounds like there's a disconnect though between the sense that the audience might have that sophistication already and what Screen Australia or other funding bodies might think the audience, how sophisticated the audience is as to what is worth funding in terms of supporting experimental filmmaking.
It's also too, I mean, I was recently doing a residency in Brisbane and was chatting to the cinema guy Jose at GOMA and you know, the way their funding is organised, I don't know how it differs, but you know, they can offer like a full retrospective of Rainer Werner Fassbinder films, like I don't know how many films, like 2,000 to 3,000 films.
Yeah.
And like I don't know what proportion of them are free for people.
Most
are free. And that's just unbelievable that you're seeing 35 mil prints of, and for me, you know, but then what was really, I didn't really get to chat to him enough about it, but I was like, well, how many people actually know about it and how many people are coming and, you know, all that money spent on getting them into the cinema there, but if you could then just...
A program like that is tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then surely...
Tens of thousands of dollars.
And it did feel to me super brutal. Oh, actually, it's been recorded. It just seemed like, wow, it would be great if there was as much as... Like, I would want to see busloads of high school kids being shipped to those movies and turn it into part of the curriculum and have, like... I don't know. It's just that sort of stuff blows my mind because... If I had access to that as a 17-year-old kid desperate to try to find films and having to go to the local Video Easy to just sort of scratch out what I could, that would change my life and change, anyway.
I'm just going to interject. Yeah, it's 7:30.
There's
probably one
Sorry.
Question.
So what was working in libraries and, you know, we are doing some work collections and people are learning how to make films. Anyway, my question is, how do you support something that you can't, how do you support practice which is so, how do we know how to improve screen literacy through our collections or what we expose people to when it's hard to predetermine the needs of the practice?
I probably teach maybe 2 weeks of the year, you know. I feel like I spend 85% of that time when teaching just breaking down ideas that it's somehow not possible and it's not actually able to be done as soon as you leave the classroom. I feel like that's the main, I don't know if that entirely answers your question, but to just make people feel as though it's absolutely achievable.
You're talking about the practice of filmmaking? Well, that's what I, again, in my clumsy way, have been advocating for, because the notion of screen literacy is as much about the makers, the practitioners, and the responsibilities with film schools. And one of the reasons I was at the Melbourne Film Festival for a couple of years, which is how I got to know Emile well, and one particular year, I mean, I've chewed your ear off with this story so many times, but there was one year, 3 or 4 years into my time there, and I'd been, there's an Iranian filmmaker who's a, one of the, well, he's died a year ago, Abbas Kiarostami, and I was determined that we would bring him to Melbourne in order to present some of his work, and we succeeded. It took us a couple of years, not as long as it takes to make a film, but fairly arduous. So I rang up the film school and I said, you're not going to believe this. Kiarostami's confirmed. He's going to come for 10 days. We'll bring him out to the film school. Let's do a day. We'll bring the films to you. I'll screen them to students. He'll talk to them. Sometimes he goes into film schools and spends like a day and he makes films with them. What do you reckon? Silence. And I thought, oh, they actually don't know who I'm talking about. And then I said, he's won the top prize at Cannes. Ah, okay, so he's won the top prize at Cannes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of tricky because the students are busy, you know, and they kind of leave at 5. But, you know, you need to understand that we kind of organise the curriculum. And I just went, we're going to bring him to you. We'll organise the screening. You tell us when, and he'll be there, and we'll be there, and it'll be incredible. And there were 10 people there. There was myself. There was Mr. Kiarostami. There were 3 people that had been following him wherever he went. There was not film students. There was, a security guy, and there were 4 students, and that was it.
That's terrible.
And that's when I thought, because that's, I mean, at its most rudimentary, by any measure, that's about screen literacy. Because that seemed to be something that didn't fit some kind of mercantile paradigm. Oh, okay, so if they meet this Iranian director and see some of his films, so is he going to say how to get into the Cannes Film Festival? Is that something that he's going to tell him? Rather than go, just sit with him and watch 2 or 3 of his films and be utterly transported, and then he will tell you about the Persian traditions of storytelling and how they have... Imagine those possibilities. If you're a writer, if you're an artist, imagine that. And that had no value. And that was profoundly one of the most depressing moments. But equally, it made me as determined to, okay, well, if the film school's not going to do that, then we're going to do that. So we're going to form, not a film school, but we're going to form a gang. It's going to be filmmakers. We're going to go and see a bunch of movies together. We're going to go to lunches and dinners with amazing filmmakers from around the world, where everybody is treated exactly on the same level, given the dignity that every artist should be given. And they're going to have an amazing 10 days, and then they'll just disappear back into wherever it was that they came from. And that for me is what screen literacy is, and it's actually that easy. It doesn't have to take structures and curriculum and, I mean, it takes consideration and passion, but it takes humanity and understanding that dignity of the artist and what's necessary. And it's very easy to take pot shots at, I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but it's easy to take pot shots at the film industry here. The problem is that very few people do, and to suggest that it's mediocrity kind of is hard. I mean, I'm not a patriotic person, but I want there to be something substantial in Australian cinema, not just as a legacy, but it's something alive and is dangerous and living, but there isn't. So that's why I take what I do very, very seriously, and so therefore screen literacy for me means it's more about that. We'll get to the audiences later. That was my point, again, not particularly well related, about this young filmmaker being asked or being instructed that he needed to think about his audience before it even shot a frame of the film. So I find that depressing. So, yeah, I'll stop now because we're running late.
What James is talking about is a thing called Accelerator. Mm. It's part of the Melbourne Film Festival. It started in 2003. So I was in Accelerator the first year it started. And being a documentary maker, I'd kind of been in this sort of atomized space, was like isolated, never been to film school, and Accelerated, the 10 or 12 filmmakers I met, I'm still best friends with to this day. So I suppose it's just, you were talking earlier, like just to get people in the room for one day, one, you know, 2 days, like but in any community, it's just remarkable how that glue can stick. Yeah.
Sorry to bring it to the code.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a quick comment as well. You guys are talking to exactly the right people because at New Carnegie we had our, as our philosophy JFDI. Do you know what that means? Just fucking do it.
Ah, right. I thought that had something to do with Jesus.
So I think we do have to say a big round, big round of applause. Thank you so much.
That was our October Cardi Party featuring James Hewison and Amiel Corton Wilson. You can discover more about what's on at ACME at www.acmi.net.au. We hope you've enjoyed this live recording and would love you to review us on iTunes. It does help other people to find out about CardiCast and lets us know we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events. And remember, folks, JFDI.